Welcome to Simple Living Works, episode 78. I'm Jerry Iverson. It's my pleasure to be your host with my guest, author, blogger, podcaster, speaker, James Howard Kunstler. If you're new to this podcast and would like more basic information about Simple Living Works, please listen clear to the end. If you're a regular, you may want to say goodbye at my cue. I've come to know Jim Kunstler's work through his podcast, called appropriately Kunstler Cast. Now I read his long and insightful weekly blog. He's best known for his books, nonfiction, and novels. He's also done considerable public speaking. In our conversation, I get better acquainted with some of his lesser-known skills, such as visual artist and children's book author. He gives us a peek at what it takes to survive as an independent, full-time writer these days. I see him as more than a social critic, but as a modern-day secular prophet, showing us the logical consequences of our extravagant lives, in which Americans will be forced to live in small-scale, localized agrarian or semi-agrarian communities. He's not all gloom and doom. He approaches his serious topic of the end of civilization as we know it with humor. Read his fascinating bio on his site or Wikipedia. Links are given for both of those in the show notes. Well, it's my pleasure to speak to James Howard Kunstler, well-known author, but also blogger and artist and speaker. And so, Jim, I really admire your work, especially your podcast lately, but you're best known for your writings. And you have written not only serious nonfiction, but also a series of novels called The World Made by Hands. And I see that both the nonfiction and the novels fit together well. So let's start with the nonfiction. And I get the feeling that you are what I call a secular prophet. You know, telling people the logical consequences of their actions. And maybe you would like to give us just an overview of your body of nonfiction work.
Well, I started in the late 1980s after I had written about eight novels. And, you know, I started out originally as a newspaper reporter and a magazine journalist in the 70s. And back then, the programming for somebody who aspired to, who was ambitious, was to write novels. And so I dropped out of journalism and kicked back, became a starving bohemian, and wrote these various novels, all of them quite different. So it's almost not worth revisiting them. But, you know, I wasn't getting rich, and I wasn't, you know, I was still having a hard time paying the light bill. And by some combination of events, I ended up writing a bunch of stories for the New York Times Sunday magazine. And one of them turned into a book proposal for a book that was eventually published as The Geography of Nowhere. It was about the fiasco of suburbia and how it came to be and what we were going to do about it. And it was a subject, you know, I was very interested all my adult life, going back to in my early days as a newspaper reporter, with the choices we'd made about how we were going to occupy the landscape. And, you know, all of the crap that we were smearing over the landscape and how it was affecting the life of the nation. And, you know, I had grown up with this my whole life. And it seemed to me that it was a huge problem and it was going to end up being an almost fatal problem for American society. That book, The Geography of Nowhere, led me to some other issues. The most obvious one being that you had to wonder how we were going to maintain our American lifestyle if we got into any trouble with petroleum. And we'd been through an earlier experience in the 1970s with two oil crises. And that was kind of a preview of coming attractions of what we might encounter later. So that led me to write a book called The Long Emergency. And some other things coincided with that. A bunch of senior geologists started retiring out of the major oil companies and publishing their dark and secret thoughts in the geology magazines and journals and monographs. And these were not publications that were read widely by the public. They were pretty, you know, technical and esoteric. But at exactly the same moment in history, the internet started to happen. And this information started getting out on the internet. And the bottom line was that all of these geologists who worked for the major oil companies knew that we were coming into some kind of an inflection point with our oil supply. And so the Long Emergency was largely concerned with that. And the peak oil problem, as it came to be called, has not gone away. We postponed it a bit with the shale oil adventure. But now that is going through a kind of a wrenching end. And we're probably going to re-encounter the peak oil problem again very soon. After I published The Long Emergency, I wrote a book called Too Much Magic. And the subtitle was Wishful Thinking, Technology, and the Fate of the Nation. And I wrote it because following the crash of 2008, the country went into a sort of wishful thinking rapture. And the ideas began to dominate the culture that some technological rescue remedies were going to allow us to avoid changing our behavior. You know, and this has been the major issue all along. You know, are we able to change our behavior in order to adjust to the resource-scarce futures that we face? In the meantime, I started writing a series of novels set in the post-economic collapse future under the rubric World Made by Hand. And the point behind them was to depict that that future in a very tactile way to get to people's senses about what it would feel like to live in that new disposition of things. And I wrote four of these books, one for each of the four seasons, and the final one was just published in July. So so that's the story.
Now, the latest one is called The Harrow of Spring?
The Harrows of Spring.
And I get the feeling that these novels, they're not dystopian. They may be a little, if you pardon the expression, sentimental, and that we're going back into traditional ways, I mean, out of necessity.
Well, I don't consider them sentimental. I consider the situation is kind of like this, that, you know, the people who are living in this future that I depict have been let down by the broken promises of technology. And they've really had to return to kind of an earlier mode of living, you know, something like an early 19th century mode of living without the kind of technological assistance that they had before. In these novels, the electricity is, you know, the electric grid is down, the internet is gone, the whole happy motoring system has faded away, and people aren't even riding bicycles. You know, when I started writing the first book in the series, I realized very soon that bicycles would be a problem because, you know, when all of the manufacturing and transportation chains had broken, you wouldn't be able to get the materials necessary to fix the bikes. You know, you wouldn't be able to get enough real rubber or synthetic rubber to replace the tires, or the complex metallurgies necessary to replace the gears and stuff. And I also realized that the pavements of the roads would probably begin to break up because we wouldn't be repairing them. And you know, you need pretty good surfaces to ride bicycles on to make the whole thing work. We take all that for granted. I mean, nobody ever thinks about this when they go around proposing, you know, a bicycle utopia. You know, the question of, okay, what are you going to ride on? But so that came up fairly early in this series of books. So, yeah, these characters have returned to earlier modes of living, you know, essentially emulating the success of the past and, you know, being able to carry on in the future. I do think that what the whole dynamic represents is what I would call a reset to earlier conditions of civilization.
Well, you have a humorous picture on your website, and I wonder if it's indicative of what you're talking about, because it has you on the hood of a really old car being pulled by a horse.
No, it's not me. I'm not in that picture.
It's
just a car. It's just a car being pulled by a horse, and you know, it's a photo that was probably taken in some place like Romania, you know, where, you know, some former Soviet republic that was struggling to get back on its feet. Well, yeah, it's a funny picture. You know, one of the things that people rarely notice about my books is that they're funny, and there's a lot of comedy in them. There's, you know, even The Long Emergency has quite a few gags in it, because let's face it, the you know, human behavior is pretty hilarious.
Yes, indeed. Well, there are so many other aspects of your work. I'd like to talk about each one of them at least briefly.
Sure.
And the one that, of course, I'm most associated with is your podcast, The Kunstler Cast.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
And frankly, I don't see how you get so much done. I mean, you blog on Mondays, you produce your podcast on Thursdays, plus you produce all these books, and it's just quite amazing. I think that the episode that I enjoyed the most recently was Alice Friedman, when she talked about when trucks stop running.
Yeah, Alice is a live wire. Alice is a very interesting figure. You know, she's been on the scene, on the energy scene for a decade or more, and she's written some books, and she's very smart, and she has an understanding, I think, a complete understanding of the dynamic that we face. So it was a pleasure talking to her about it, and I enjoy talking to interesting people. I would say, though, that podcasting is the activity I do that I have the least confidence in. It's not something that I don't feel that comfortable behind the microphone, at least, you know, conducting the interview. And I have to do all the technical stuff myself. I don't have any, you know, helper who's editing the recording or anything. So, yeah, it's a lot. And I don't do it every week. I do it about once a month.
Well, I noticed that you have a kind of a regular stable of people. You have people that come back from time to time, you know. I wouldn't call them regular guests, but it seems like you have guests that come back from time to time. So
yeah, I check in with these guys who, you know, these people who have a particular point of view and a particular voice that I think is valuable. But I don't do it all the time. I'm always sort of reaching out for some new people, and I do.
I noticed that you had a colleague with your podcast for a while, and then you produced a book about your podcasts, and now you're doing it solo. And being a podcaster myself, I can really appreciate and empathize with how much has to go into that effort. So thank you for that.
Well, yeah, what happened was, you know, I hadn't actually thought about podcasting, and this young guy who lives near me suggested that, you know, he had read my books, he liked my books, and he thought he could help me put together a podcast and kind of be my podcasting sidekick. And so we did it. And, you know, the good part of it was that he produced all the shows, and he edited them and put them together and got them on the air. And he was quite a bit younger than me, and he was starting out in his career, and he needed to pay more attention to his own activities. So he went, he showed me how to do it myself, and we parted ways, but he's still my website manager, so we're still good friends.
Good. Well, the same thing happened to me. A young guy mentored me, and for which I'm very grateful. So let's move on. Some people may find the name of your blog a little disconcerting. It's called Clusterfuck Nation. And in this, you comment on current events. So it seems to be a little different approach than your books.
Well, I don't know if it's that different. You know, it's a kind of a discipline in and of itself, writing a once-a-week blog where, you know, you have to be coherent and you have to present some kind of an argument that makes sense and to do it in an entertaining way. And I almost always write it the morning that I publish it. I get up at 6 o'clock in the morning, write the blog in 3 hours, and, you know, post it by 9 or 9:30. And like I said, it's, you know, it's a discipline, and I feel it's valuable because, you know, it keeps me on my toes.
Well, it seems like you're a disciplined guy. You must, you know, devote a certain amount of time to other writings as well. Now, you said that the Heroes of Spring is the last of the Made by Hands, World Made by Hands novel series. What do we have look forward to next?
Well, I'm finishing another novel right now, which is set on a Vermont hippie commune in 1968, narrated by a 19-year-old girl. And I've had a great time with this book. And I'm, you know, a few days really from wrapping it up. So I've been doing that for about the last 9 months, and it's been a great adventure. I'm very excited about it. And after that, I got another project that I probably won't talk about, but, you know, I just keep on, you know, keep on doing it.
Can you tease us with the title of your new novel?
It's called Green Mountain Reel. That's the working title. I don't know if it'll be the final title. You know, often the publisher, whoever that ends up being, will hassle me about the title. And you know, and we'll have to forge something new. But for the moment, that's what it is.
Well, I've noticed that you are taking an approach to fundraising or providing more income streams that other podcasters are using as well. That is crowdsourcing.
Yeah, I'm using the Patreon system, which is the Patreon thing is, you know, a company, a website of its own that helps you get contributions, and then you know, it makes sure that the credit cards are processed, and it does all the technical stuff for this. I really had to do it because the four World Made by Hand books were all published by the Atlantic Monthly Press, and I wrote the first two books, and then my agent went looking for a contract for the final two books. And we were determined to keep all four books with the same publisher, which is a good thing. The problem was, though, in a contract negotiation, I didn't have any leverage. You know, I couldn't say, I'll take these books somewhere else if you don't pay me enough money to do them. So they kind of lowballed me on the contract, and I had a pretty bad contract for those two books. But I felt like I had to do it, and I had to just kind of soldier on and grind them out and do the best I could. But in the meantime, I wasn't getting paid very much, and I also started to encounter problems on the college lecture circuit, where I'd been making really the bulk of my income for quite a few years. As the social justice fiesta started to warm up on campus, and students became uncomfortable with ideas that upset them, it became harder and harder for my lecture agent to get me gigs on the college scene. And it's actually been true for a lot of other, you know, speakers, writers, authors who deal in uncomfortable ideas. So the whole campus scene has really created a problem. So anyway, you know, I was really hurting for revenue, so I needed a way to get paid. And, you know, I did this blog for basically for free for years. And that's the big problem with the internet, is that up until fairly recently, it's been very difficult for serious writers who have made a career in writing to get paid for what they do. And the Patreon system really helped a lot. It really helped me out of a jam. and it allowed me to finish, you know, the book that I'm currently working on. So I was very grateful for that whole system being, you know, ramped up.
No, I understand that you've also spoken before a number of organizations dealing with architecture and design, and at the same time, you claim to have no formal training in architecture and design. So how does that work?
Well, my book, The Geography of Nowhere, was about, as I said, the fiasco of suburbia, but it was also about the failures of architecture and urban design in our time, and their failure to deliver a human habitat that was really nourishing and comfortable for the human spirit, as well as for, you know, the American economy and our social lives. And, you know, that led me into a whole world of architecture and urban design. And I got the equivalent of a graduate school education by writing three books about cities and suburbs and the design of the human habitat. So, you know, I wrote The Geography of Nowhere, and then I followed that up with Home from Nowhere, which was largely about the new urbanist movement, which was a great reform movement that started in the 90s to change the way that we designed our communities and change the laws and codes and zoning that mandated a pretty bad outcome. Namely, you know, mandated suburban sprawl. And that movement is still with us. It's been a fairly successful movement, although the habits and practices of the building industry are pretty entrenched, and they tend to keep on doing the same old stupid thing over and over again. And, you know, as a consequence, we keep on just elaborating the suburban fiasco. And I like to refer to it these days as the greatest misallocation of resources in the history of the world. And by that, I mean, you know, we've wasted our national wealth building this system for living, for daily life, that really doesn't have much of a future. We're going to have to do things a lot differently, and we're not prepared to do it. And in all of these, you know, all of that really ends up expressing itself in the incoherence of the election that we're now engaged in and the craziness of our contemporary politics.
The new urbanism movement tries to make it more walker-friendly, neighborhoods smaller, closer to schools, those kinds of things. I get the feeling that that is kind of a niche market. And I say that coming from the voluntary simplicity movement. You know, I've spent much of my life promoting voluntary simplicity, but I've come to realize too that voluntary simplicity is kind of a niche market. That is, there is a small number of very sincere followers. And so I see some similarities between the two.
Well, I think it's a mistake to think of either of them as being niche issues. You know, the new urbanism was not about catering to just one economic group of Americans. It wasn't just about catering to the upper middle class. The new urbanism was a comprehensive movement to really reform the way we live and to find ways to get us into living arrangements that would really be much more satisfying. You know, any American, suburban American who has been to a European city like Amsterdam or Barcelona or Stockholm or Copenhagen or Paris, you know, notices the obvious differences between the quality of daily life there and the quality of daily life in America. And, you know, we have just thrown a lot of knowledge and skill in the garbage can. And the new urbanist movement was largely about diving into that dumpster of history and retrieving the skills and the principles that had allowed us to build places that were more comfortable, you know, before the automobile came to dominate everything in American life. And, you know, life is tragic, by which I mean, you know, societies sometimes make bad decisions, bad choices, and then they have to pay the price for that. And we're facing the consequences of that right now, you know, with a living arrangement that has no future and an economy that can't be sustained. So both the New Urbanism movement and the Simplicity movement have a great deal in common. We're not trying to take stuff away from people and take their stuff away, but we are trying to get across the point that there are much more satisfying ways of arranging life on the landscape.
One subject that I don't see addressed very much in your work, I've heard it from time to time, but not as a major theme, is population control.
I've addressed it. And what I've said is this, is that there's no question that we are in a situation of population overshoot, but we're not going to do anything about it. There's not going to be any set of policies or protocols that are going to remediate the population overshoot. What's going to happen is, you know, the usual suspects are going to come along and they're going to do their thing and the population's going to go down. Now, what's going to happen in the meantime, you know, is that people continue to have sex and reproduce and have children, even under conditions of hardship. But as we reach the inflection points ahead where, you know, we start to have a real problem with a wobbling economy, ultimately the population is going to start going down. And it'll probably, you know, the fall is probably going to be pretty swift and pretty drastic when it does begin to happen.
I'd like to compare my vision, and you can critique it if you'd like, and that is that by continuing on the path we're on now with degrading the environment, that about 2040, we'll begin what I call the environmental implosion, and that things will get so bad, there'll be so much suffering, that by the year 2100, the population of the world will have been reduced from 9 billion to about 1 billion, which is the carrying capacity of the optimal carrying capacity of the Earth. And so that sounds terrible, but on the other hand, for me, that's optimistic because we'll be giving the Earth a chance to renew itself.
I don't disagree with that, although I think the timeline might end up being a bit more compressed. I see us getting into trouble rather sooner than later, and I see the thing playing out sooner than the beginning of the next century. But yeah, I go along with that. The figure of 1 billion, I think, comes from an idea or a theory or an assumption that was roughly the population of the planet before the industrial era took off, and therefore it might be theoretically a workable population level when the techno-industrial adventure comes to an end. But I have an inkling that the actual figure might end up being somewhat lower, you know, under 1 billion people. But we'll see. And, you know, the really salient question is, what is that journey like from where we're at now to where we're going, and how much hardship will be entailed, and what will the quality of that period of time be in history, and you know, what happens? I tried to address that in my World Made by Hand novels. That was the whole purpose of it.
Well, thank you for that. I'd like to move on to something a little more lighthearted, if you don't mind.
Sure. I like comedy.
I admire your art as well as your writing, and I think a lot of your art is what I would call tongue-in-cheek.
Oh, no, it's not really tongue-in-cheek at all. No, it might seem that way, for people who haven't seen my paintings, which is probably most people. They are on my website, but it's not a major feature of, you know, what I do, or at least on the public side of what I do. But I have been pretty serious about painting my whole life. And when I was a kid, I went to a special high school in New York called the High School of Music and Art. And I got a pretty good basic art education there, you know, how to use various materials and, you know, how to develop an attitude about what you're looking at and how to see what you're looking at and all that. So I've been painting, you know, the world around me. I'm a representational painter, but I have a particular style, and I use the materials in a particular way. And I depict what's out there. If, you know, I often paint the local roads with the cars on them, and I paint the shopping strips sometimes. And I like to print the human I like to paint the human imprint on the landscape. Now, where I live in the Upper Hudson Valley, there happened to be a lot of industrial ruins. You know, a lot of the remains of the factories that were running here until the 1970s, and things like the trolley trestles and the interurban trolley trestles and the railroad trestles and all these amazing sort of concrete structures that are now fading into nature. And there were painters in 19th century America who used to routinely go to Italy to study and train when they were young. People like Thomas Cole, figures that came out of the so-called Hudson River School of Painting in the 1840s and 50s. And they'd go to Rome and range around Italy and paint all the ruined aqueducts and the Roman structures and stuff. And to me, that's what I'm seeing here in the Upper Hudson Valley, you know, in the ruins of the Industrial Age. So I'm kind of fascinated by it, but it's not comedy at all, really. It's not tongue in cheek. It's what's out there. You know, if you go back and look at the paintings of the great American artist Edward Hopper from the 1920s and 30s, he was doing something very similar, but the world that he depicted, the world of 1930s gas stations and small towns on Cape Cod with the cars in them and stuff and the railroad tracks, that world that he painted in 1920 and 1930, you know, that world has vanished now too. So, in a way, he was painting the history of his time, and I'm trying to capture the history of my time. So it's a serious enterprise.
And those paintings are for sale. I notice some have been sold.
Yeah.
Are you?
Oh yeah, a lot of them.
Are you issuing any prints, or are we looking strictly at Kunstler originals?
Yeah, for now they're Kunstler originals, and I must say I don't really market them very aggressively. They're there if people want to see them, but you know, I'm not out huckstering for them. I kind of would like to do prints, but it's that would be a project that my website manager would have to help me with, because you know, I at the moment I don't have time to arrange that.
Well, now I'm also curious. I noticed that you were at one time married to a woman who was a children's book writer, and you have written some children's books, but I don't see them listed on your much of your biographical material. There was one about Annie Oakley, one about Johnny Appleseed. Was this just sort of a novelty, or is this something that you...
Yeah, it was sort of a novelty. Actually, what happened was in the early 90s, a company that made children's videos approached me. There was a guy who worked there who, for one reason or another, liked my work. He liked my early novels, and he asked me to write video scripts about American folklore themes. So I wrote about a half a dozen of them for Rabbit Ears Productions, and they were very well done things. You know, they especially were good at getting really great musicians to do the music, like Mark O'Connor did the music for my Johnny Appleseed thing. He's the greatest fiddler in America. And Ry Cooter did the music for another thing. And, you know, really great musicians, and they got great narrators to read them. And the videos had very interesting artwork in them. They were subsequently turned into books. They used the art and the... the scripts to make them into books without the music, obviously, and the narration. So that wasn't really, you know, and also I only got paid like a set fee for writing the script for each one. I didn't get a cut of any royalties in that. So, you know, I would write the script and get paid for it, and that would be the end of it. So Subsequently, Rabbit Ears Production sold those that backlist of books to another publisher, and it was resold several times. And I don't even know who has the rights now. You know, I don't really keep up with it. I did write another series of short novellas that were not children's books per se, but they were about a kid. I wrote five of these novellas about a kid growing up in New York City in the early 1960s. And I advertise them on my website. I don't know that they sell very well, but that was kind of a side job to see if there was a market for small books that could be sold fairly cheaply. And the outcome really isn't, we don't really know how that's going to work out in the long run yet.
Well, I don't want to be morbid, but are you looking forward to retirement? Do you think you're going to die at your...
Oh, God, no.
Do you think you're going to die at your computer?
Well, that's not how I would like to go in front of a screen, but no, I'm not going to retire. I mean, I really love doing what I do, and I don't see any reason why I can't keep it up until I'm either, you know, incapacitated or out of here. And you know, I produced more books in my 60s, I think, than I did in any other period of my life. So yeah, I like doing it. You know, it is interesting. Getting old is an interesting experience. As Betty Davis once said, it's not for sissies. You know, it entails a lot of difficulty. None of it particularly interesting, but I don't know. I'm going to keep on keeping on.
There you go. Well, this has been a real delight for me, and I just want to let you give us any parting thoughts.
Well, I don't have any. I think that this year has been kind of an inflection point for the American economy and society, and you know, we're having an election that's hardly worthy of the worst third world nation, and I don't think it's going to end well if either of them wins. And we're in for some interesting times, as the Chinese used to say. And gird your loins and try to be kind to each other, and let's do what we can to salvage this culture.
Thank you so much, Jim. Keep on keeping on.
Okay, Jerry, thanks. Nice talking to you.
Be well.
You too.
You've been listening to my conversation with author, blogger, podcaster, speaker, James Howard Kunstler. You're welcome to share your thoughts on these subjects. Email a message to simplelivingworks@yahoo.com, on our Facebook page, or on the Simple Living Works blog. Those addresses are given in the show notes at our website, simplelivingworks.org. Click window number 3. Time to wrap up this episode of Simple Living Works podcast. If you're new to Simple Living Works podcast and would like more basic information about Simple Living Works, please listen a little longer. If you're a regular, you may want to say goodbye here. Peace. If you haven't subscribed yet, we hope you will through iTunes, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast service. Remember that you can listen to all episodes of Simple Living Works. They're archived twice. Access them at simplelivingworks.org, window number 3, click Preview, Backup, and choose the episodes you want, with or without show notes. Subscriptions to this podcast and to our weekly blog are free, and they keep you current automatically when we post something new. Urge your friends to do the same. Remember to like us on Facebook. You can also subscribe in iTunes to my other podcast, The Common Good Podcast, which I produce and co-host with Jubilee One Earth Economics. Send us your email address to receive the free monthly Simple Living Works e-news. Thanks to the band Earth Mama and to John Pitney for the music on our show. This podcast is covered by the Creative Commons Non-Commercial Attribution Share-Alike license. To learn more about Creative Commons, click on its link on our website homepage. We do not solicit or accept donations, nor do we sell anything. All our resources and services are free of charge. We're an all-volunteer organization. We at Simple Living Works believe that simple living really does work. Voluntary simplicity, choosing to live simpler lives, is a faithful, satisfying, effective, comprehensive way of life. It's not a lift to rules nor living on the cheap. It avoids fads, convenience, and deprivation. It's so much more than a hobby. We believe in abundance, that there's enough for everybody's need, but not anybody's greed. We follow the saying, live simply, that others may simply live, as our closing theme song proclaims. It's a balance of personal responsibility and advocacy for just public policy. It's more than personal happiness, though that's quite important. Contemporary faith-based simple living is guided by the five life standards of Living More with Less, the classic by Doris Jansen Longacre, and I've discussed these standards in earlier episodes. The mission of Simple Living Works is equipping people of faith to challenge consumerism, live justly, and celebrate responsibly. We extend the mission and resources of the nonprofit organization Alternatives, which served from 1973 to 2011. The three parts of our mission are elaborated in text and video. Links are listed in the show notes. We produce a half-hour podcast twice a month, hopefully educational and inspiring for you, your family, and your congregation or group. Until next time, this is Jerry Iverson of Simple Living Works podcast, wishing you well as we strive to challenge consumerism, live justly, and celebrate responsibly. Others can simply live, learn to live simply, so others can simply live, learn to live simply, so others can live. Mm-hmm.